Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another edition of Dead Pit Radio. I am Uncle Bill.
And I am the Creepy Cadugan, if you will.
My God, you're in for a treat this week.
We have,
as our special interview this week, in case you've been in a cave somewhere and didn't know about it, is Uncle Charlie Band, the founder of Full Moon Entertainment, Wizard Entertainment, Empire Pictures, and about 14 other companies that I can't remember right now.
Yeah, and actually, it's an interview that we did because you, the fan, wanted it.
That's right. Which is the reason why we do most everything that we do here. But yeah, he's going to talk about the Puppet Master series, the Trancer series, box sets that, were released and then were pulled, just all kinds of other stuff.
The future of those franchises we mentioned before, sequels and stuff. He's a big fan of sequels.
He's a big fan of puppets, too, and dolls and shit.
But we got a lot of news to get to here in a little bit, and DVD reviews.
Now, we've got tons of DVD reviews. Again, for some reason, we said we're going to cut down on DVD reviews.
Well, we are going to cut down on them soon, but this week, yeah, we're insane. Don't say that.
We've got six this week, and actually, we've got one that I'd heard about for a really long time and just got a chance to see. It's called Andre the Butcher. We'll be talking about that one.
Think Film. We have a movie from Amy Lynn Best, which I thought was a really great independent documentary, The Spicy Sisters Slumber Party.
We have a Lance Henriksen vehicle here that was directed by Don Michael Paul and released by Anchor Bay recently, and this is called The Garden.
Yeah, and we also have an independent film by the name of After Sundown, which is an odd combination of zombies and vampires.
And we'll be talking about that a little bit later. And we have a film here called H6, which is actually a Spanish
Diary
foray.
Of the Serial Killer.
And it's a Spanish foray into the torture genre.
And I think it's probably the first Spanish horror film we've ever reviewed on the show.
I think it is, too. Yeah. And finally, this week, we have what could quite possibly be my very favorite kind of fan documentary ever made. Yeah. This is released by Anchor Bay, and it's called Halloween 25 Years of Terror.
Which I don't even know if we should review it, because anybody that's a fan of the Halloween franchise has probably already pre-ordered it, if you're on the internet. But,
well, by review, I just mean I'm going to tell you everything that's on it. It really pretty much sells itself.
Yeah.
So,
just read the back of it, and that's all you need to do. But I guess we can get right into the news. There's not a whole lot of stuff to talk about. It's more of the same sort of stuff we were talking about last week.
But thankfully, they haven't released any more remakes this week, I don't think. They released like five
but
last week.
We get more info on some remakes we were talking about last week, such as the Day of the Dead remake. I know that screenwriter Jeffrey Reddick has some cast reports that I had to look at this twice really quickly yesterday because Ving Rhames, he's going to be portraying Captain Rhodes.
Who was originally portrayed by Joe Pilato in a role that probably will never be taught by anybody.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine this cast.
I didn't expect this at all, actually. I thought they were going to go a completely different direction and not even use characters from the original. It seems like he's going to be in that role, and American Beauty's Mina Suvari will play Sarah, which was played by Lori Cardell, who we talked to on here a few months ago.
Another amazing casting choice.
Yeah. So what do you think about this?
My initial thoughts on this were kind of funny because I think one of the very first things that I heard about this movie was that it wasn't going to be a WB-driven cast in a horror film. And I think every one of these people in this film have been on a WB show at one time or another, except maybe Ving Rhames.
Yeah.
Look, I've said this before on the board, and I'll say it here too. There's two things that I think could possibly separate this movie from being completely horrible.
Right.
And that's the writer, who is Jeffrey Riddick, the guy that wrote Final Destination, and the director, who is Steve Miner, who at one time or another, he directed House and Friday the 13th, 2, I think. And
2 and 3.
3. Yeah. And, if any two people could save that from such a horrible cast, it'd probably be them.
Yeah, you mentioned Steve Miner, though. He's in Bulgaria right now prepping for the shoot, which I believe is starting a couple of days.
Yeah.
So, it's starting July 23rd. I don't know. I mean, we will go see it simply because we're massive zombie fans. We'll go see about any zombie movie that comes out, no matter what it is. But I don't know. It's just another remake.
I remember when the Hills Have Eyes remake came out, we thought that the only thing that could save it would probably be Alexander Aja.
Right.
And to some extent, we were right because, I know we didn't like the film as much as we thought, but it would have been a lot worse.
Yeah, the visuals and stuff made that movie halfway watchable, at least.
But the next big story that I guess came out this week that I want to talk about is a film that I don't know how long this damn thing's been delayed, but it's been years, I know. It's called Return to Sleepaway Camp, which is supposed to be the sequel. The official sequel that picks up, I guess, where Sleepaway Camp left off. They just disregard 2 and 3. But it's supposed to actually, according to this, will be finished this summer with hopefully some kind of release toward like Halloween, around Halloween. But the Return to Sleepaway Camp is supposed to continue the story where a greedy camper and junior partner do their best to keep everyone in line at the camp. But something sinister is about to put a stop to the camping. And it's supposed to pick up like right after, I guess, the camp was closed, part one, because of the murders. But from what I can read about it, the whole thing is supposed to be a mixture of CGI and practical effects. Robert Hiltzik, who is the guy that directed the first one, is coming back as director. It's got Felicia Rose in it. And it's been reported to come out for, like I said, years now.
I think they filmed it in 2003.
But according to this, it's supposed to be out by Halloween, but who knows at this point.
Yeah, and they've actually already announced another Sleepaway Camp.
Yeah, I heard about this.
Movie called Sleepaway Camp Reunion.
Shit, when I heard about that, I was like, let's just let them release Return to Sleepaway Camp first.
Yeah, I think that's been a long out there because, you know, they're still reshooting scenes from Return to Sleepaway Camp, which, oh, God, I mean, that'll probably delay it at least another year. They say they want to have it out by Halloween. There's no way if they're still shooting stuff. So,
well, most of this stuff, though, I think at one point or another they've said this movie's going to be out at certain dates at least 3 or 4 different times, so who knows.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to see it. That's one of those movies that I've been... Well, I've looked forward to it for so long that I've just about forgot about it now.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like the new Guns N' Roses album.
Yeah.
But it's not that bad.
No, it's not been 10 years yet, I don't know.
We finally got a release date for Slither. It's going to be coming out October 24th. You're going to have your standard anamorphic widescreen and Dolby Digital 5.1 audio. Some extras include audio commentary with director James Gunn and star Nathan Fillion. Deleted and extended scenes with optional commentary by Gunn. The Slick Minds and Slimy Days of Slither making a featurette. Who is Bill Pardee's featurette? The King of Cult, Lloyd Kaufman's video diary, which is pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of bizarre because I think Universal's releasing it.
That is bizarre.
They're going to have a Lloyd Kaufman feature on there. Anyway, Bringing Slither's Creatures to Life featurette, The Gorehound Grill, Brewing the Blood featurette, you know, all kinds of featurettes and creamy horror goodness. And the retail price is $29.98 with an HD DVD version available for $39.98. What do you think of that?
That's another movie that I don't think got a good deal of the credit it deserved, and it didn't get any hype whatsoever. Nope. Basically fell off the planet after the first week it was out.
Well, it actually, it had a fair amount of TV spots and stuff. It's obvious, though, that the mainstream audience just didn't want it.
And that's why we got like 6 remakes a week now. But
and video games.
And by the way, for all people that are wondering, no, we're never going to stop bitching about remakes. It's probably never going to happen.
Well, this is a horror show. Mm-hmm. When 9 out of 10 movies that come out that's horror is either a remake or it's based on a video game, I mean, we have to talk about it.
That's right.
And if we didn't want to.
I feel obliged not only to talk about it, but to bitch about it. Because that's just what I do. But anyway, I know some people will be interested in this, though, that director Juan Carlos Fresnadillo will be helming 28 Weeks Later, which picks up 6 months after the Rage virus has decimated the city of London. And then just a brief plot synopsis. The U.S. Army has restored order and is repopulating the quarantine city when a carrier of the Rage virus enters London and unknowingly reignites the spread of the deadly infection, wreaking havoc on the entire population. And 28 days later, The Aftermath is also being released at the exact same time as 28 Weeks Later, the movie, which is
it's a comic book.
It's a novel, a graphic novel, around the same thing.
Isn't the same company, I think, releasing Hills Have Eyes 2?
Yeah, it is. Atomic Comics is the name of the thing that's doing the graphic novel. But yeah, speaking of Hills Have Eyes 2, shooting starts in Morocco, September the 4th.
Yeah, I think that's pushing for the same like, what, April or March, whenever it came out for next year.
Could be. I don't know.
Anyway, we got some news on Scott Goldberg films.
That's right.
Scott mentioned we are in official pre-production for two short horror films shooting this August and October in 2006. The Forest Hills and All I Want for Halloween, which is, you know, a sequel to All I Want for Christmas. Mm-hmm. The Forest Hills is a short horror film which follows two horror journalists who travel to the Kentucky woods to document an urban legend about murders that took place deep in the Forest Hills. The screenplay was written by Scott W. Perry of Unadulterated and will be shooting in late August 2006. And being the highly trained actors that we are, we're supposed to be in that movie.
That's right. I think what was our characters? Buck and...
Chuck and Buck.
Yeah, Chuck and Buck.
And oddly enough, I was telling him today that there's actually a town called Forest Hills.
There really, yeah. We were
in Kentucky.
We looked that up a while back, and that's amazing, but there really is. I don't know. Did he know that before?
No, he didn't know that.
Well, yeah, we like to, you know, wish Goldberg the best of luck with all those projects, and hopefully the Forest Hills will turn out well, and wish him best of luck with that new haircut, too.
Yeah. All I Want for Halloween is the second episode in the All I Want for Christmas series, which follows the demented rapist Santa Cruz, played by Chico Mendez, who is a Goldberg regular, as he runs into many very sticky situations. The first episode, All I Want for Christmas, which we shot in early 2006, will be playing in a few horror film festivals this fall and is available to watch online over on YouTube. You can look for it. And he mentioned ideas for the All I Want for Christmas feature length film are currently being written based off of the first two episodes and is planned to start production in early 2008. So, yeah, if you want to keep up with all of Scott Goldberg's projects.
Shenanigans.
Yeah. ScottGoldbergFilms.com or MySpace.com/ScottGoldberg, and he'll keep you updated. Guarantee it.
Yep. And you'd mentioned about The Hills Have Eyes, too. I was just looking on here. That is supposed to be released in theaters March the 2nd in 2007. 28 weeks later, will supposed to be released May 11th, 2007. And the Alien vs. Predator 2 has been shifted from its previously announced August 10th to December 21st. These are all being released by 20th Century Fox.
So, AVP 2 is this December?
Yep. Well,
or next
sorry,
December.
December 21st of 2007.
Okay. Oh, man, I can't wait that long for it.
I know. I'm on there looking at the dailies every fucking day. I just check them out, see how the shooting's going, because I love the first movie so much.
Yeah. I suppose we should take a quick break, though, and we'll be back with some more horror news from Creamy Horror.
Yeah, you cream your jeans.
It's creamy. We'll be right back here on
DudePoot.com.
On October 20th through 22nd, 2006, in Racine, Wisconsin, it is It Came From Lake Michigan. Wisconsin's only horror film festival. All independent filmmakers nationwide are welcome to participate in It Came From Lake Michigan, with special guests including Lloyd Kaufman, Fred Olin Ray, Brink Stevens, Debbie Rochon, Susie Lorraine, Jason Paul Collum, Scott Goldberg, and many more. Be sure to check out It Came From Lake Michigan.com, or it might just come for you.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Deadbeat Radio. I just want to, you know, briefly talk about a couple of sequels that are coming out in the near future that I can't even fathom how horrible they're going to be.
Right.
You got, first off, White Noise 2, because there's Lake so Boogaloo. Many unanswered questions that I have to know from White Noise. That's coming out January the 5th, 2007.
The one main question I wanted to ask was, why did they think it was a good idea to hire Michael Keaton in a movie?
I don't know. All I know, all I know about Michael Keaton is he's Batman. That's all you need to know.
Yeah.
But the Butterfly Effect 2... is another one that's coming out. And right. I saw like the DVD cover for this. It's coming straight to DVD, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, somebody was telling me about the trailer is actually available, and they said it looked really bad.
But this is supposed to be only on DVD by October the 10th. New Line's releasing this, so it has all the regular widescreen anamorphic 5.1 shit on it. But who cares with a movie that shitty?
Yeah, but I mean, I really did like the original movie.
I did too. But seriously, does there need to be a Butterfly Effect 2?
No.
I mean, and another one that should... Somebody asked a question one time about what we thought, you know, certain franchises should just stop making films. And this is one that I think. Species 4 is coming out. I think that Species, the original Species, was good enough. You didn't really need 2 and 3, and now
yeah, I didn't 4. Even think the first Species was that great, really.
But this is going to be released, apparently it hits just DVD on December.
I think the best, the thing that makes people think the first Species was good is because you see Natasha Henstridge, is that her name?
Yeah.
You see her completely naked a lot of the time, so.
I think that is the big draw for that film, actually.
Yeah, because it's really not that good of a movie besides that. We got something from Bob Kurtzman, by the way. Sent us an email, and this guy's cool as hell. I just wanted to say on the show, hey guys, what's up? I love the look of the new site. Please keep up the work. Did you see that Fangoria is now doing a radio show? You guys did it first. That's right. Anyway, though, he mentioned, I just wanted to drop a line and let you know that I've just wrapped Buried Alive in New Mexico. The shoot went great, and we had a blast working with the cast and crew. We're officially wrapped on the shooting of the Horror Chronicles. Now he's going to be doing the post work on that, which I guess is computer effects and stuff. Just told us to keep up the great work. And he's also sent us a bunch of photos that we have on the message board from the shoot. And you can check that out over on deadpit.com.
One of my favorite things about that, especially that one in Undead or Alive, because I actually had seen some pictures of that previously, was that it's all makeup effects, it looks like. I mean, most everything he created himself. And I don't know if a lot of people know this, but Kurtzman actually is like one of the better mask designers
out there. Sculptors.
Yeah, and sculptors. But, yeah, I look forward to both those movies, Buried Alive and Wanted, Undead or Alive, when they come out.
Yeah.
Also.
And Living Hell.
Yeah. Also, though, this was just so damn funny that I had to bring it up. There's actually a musical right now about Evil Dead.
Yeah.
It's called just that, Evil Dead the Musical.
Right.
It's going to start an unlimited off-Broadway run. And the playbill states that the cast is in charge of songs like All the Men in My Life Keep Being Killed by Gondarian Demons, Look Who's Evil Now, and Do the Necronomicon. So,
yeah.
You know, there's nobody in the film that I know of, but it says the cast includes Jennifer Byrne, Jenna Coker, Renee Klapmeyer, Amy Shute, none of these people I don't
know. Yeah, and I heard it was actually amazing that they actually, something that's difficult to do to have a play like that actually on off-Broadway in New York.
It is, yeah. But the show is $25 and running right now in New York, like you said. And apparently, it's kind of fan interactive, which means that the people that go there get drenched with fake blood, apparently.
Yeah,
and
then they have a section called the Splatter Zone.
Yeah, the Splatter Zone, which is... it's kind of like, I don't know if you all remember Gallagher, but he used to like smash fruit and shit, and people that sit in the front of his shows would always get the stuff all over them.
Like some of them would wear raincoats and shit.
Yeah, they'd have like big plastic sheets. But anyway, if you want any more information about this, there's actually a site, evildeadthemusical.com.
Right. Our good friend Rolf Kaniski wanted us to mention that The Nightmare Man is going to be exclusively in theaters in West Hollywood starting on August 4th. You can go to LaMail's Sunset 5 Theaters, 8000 Sunset Boulevard in West Hollywood, and check that out starting August 4th. That's a freaking kick-ass movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go to LaMail.com for the show times and check out previews and trailers at NightmareManMovie.com or MySpace.com/NightmareManTheMovie.
Yeah, which we had a chance to see like an advanced screener of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And we both really, really loved the movie. Probably his best film. And I was a big fan of his before this movie even came out. So that's
I think the thing about Nightmare Man that was different from his other movies is it actually looked like it had a huge budget. And I don't, I'm pretty sure it didn't.
No, yeah. I'm pretty sure.
It looked very polished.
A couple notes about future DVDs that are coming out. And I did not really care too much for this episode, but I don't know, some people might have. But there was an episode of Masters of Horror that was called Dance of the Dead.
Yeah.
It was Toby Hooper's episode. I didn't really care for it that much.
It was the worst episode of the whole series. Let's go ahead and say it.
Shit, I wouldn't say that. There's like...
Well, it's the worst one I saw. There's a few I didn't see.
I think the... Was it the Deer Woman?
I didn't see that.
Oh, God, that's probably the worst one I remember. But anyway, the point being is that Anchor Bay will release that on September the 12th. And it'll have all the Anchor Bay specials that you've come to know and love.
Yeah, I can say this about those Anchor Bay DVDs. I reviewed a copy of The Homecoming, which is Joe Dante's, and that's on the message board. Or, I mean, not on the message board. That's on the website. And they really did stick a shitload of extras on there. So if you're a fan of those, you might want to pick it up.
And I have to say I was a fan of most of the Masters of Horror. There was just maybe... two or three on there that I probably wouldn't ever watch again.
Yeah.
And that happened to be one of them.
We got something on Fear Mongas.
Which is the big independent Masters of Horror.
Yeah, the series of one-hour horror movies being put together by creator, producer, directors Ryan Nicholson and Nick Palumbo, who's...
Where you at, Nick?
Very controversial, if you will.
Yeah.
They've added and subtracted a few names from the roster of filmmakers. Ruggero Deodato, who is the Italian...
He's the king of cannibal movies, I guess.
Yeah. He's been added. In addition, Graham Whiffler, who did the movie Neighborhood Watch, which we haven't seen yet, has joined the roster. But leaving the group of Fear Mongas is one of our favorite independent... one of our favorite slasher movies he did, Jeff Lieberman. He's leaving the Fear Mongers set. Group.
I have to say, though, that when I first read that list of people, I thought that he was actually the one that least fit in with that
group. Because his movies really weren't independent. I guess you could consider them independent, but they were released nationally.
Not only that, but they just don't have the same... I mean, for 80s kind of slasher and, you know, genre films, they were pretty high budget, I would think.
I really don't think Deodato fits that much either, but...
Well,
he'd fit more in with the Italian Masters of Horror thing that he was talking about.
I guess they didn't invite him to that, though.
Quite didn't.
Why is it that?
Yeah.
But got some news about Guillermo del Toro, who has apparently got like 15 projects going at one time. I know he's doing that Pan's Labyrinth project right now, too. But
yeah.
He's supposed to be teaming up with Angry Films to bring a DC comic book adaptation of Dead Man to the big screen. Which I never read that. Not a big comic book fan anymore. But Del Toro is in negotiations to develop the comic to film's adaptation, which would be produced by himself, Murphy, and Susan Montford. But Dead Man is the ghost of a circus acrobat named Boston Brand, who was murdered during a trapeze performance. I could have swore there was something about somebody being murdered during a trapeze performance. Robin from Batman? Wasn't his family murdered by...
I have no idea.
Two-Face? Yeah. His family was murdered by Two-Face in a trapeze thing just like that.
Yeah. Two-Face is the son of a bitch.
He is.
Tell him, you don't mess with Two-Face.
Tommy Lee Jones sucked in that movie, too.
That movie sucked ass, period. I got a couple of screenings I want to get to. Summer Camp Double Feature Horror Classics at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, New York, which are... good pal Scott Goldberg goes to these so he can piss us off even more. We have a double feature of Bob Clark's Black Christmas and James Gunn's Slither.
That's an odd double feature.
It is. But it's going to be every Saturday they're going to have these double features at 11 p.m. at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, New York. And Metropole NYC, who we often talk about on here, Monday, July 24th, it's Return of the Living Dead. You get free admission with a one-drink minimum. Go over to MetropoleNYC.com for more info.
And now, for the next Tuesday's DVD releases.
Yay!
and actually, we reviewed one of these films already, and we'll probably be reviewing another one by next week's show. But Dark Sky is releasing Asylum, which we talked about.
Awesome.
And they're also releasing And Now the Screaming Starts.
Awesome.
We haven't seen it yet, but we'll...
They're all awesome. I'm sure they are.
probably review that next week. And The Beast Must Die. All those movies are coming
That'll
out.
That'll be awesome,
week.
Too.
Also, another awesome thing that'll be coming out is the Dark Shadows collection number 25.
Oh, God.
From MTI.
I'm only on part 3 right now. 25.
Another interesting DVD is the Final Destination 3 DVD that you've seen advertised probably by now on television that has you have the ability to choose whether the character lives or dies through the Infinifilm, you know, version film. And we don't want to forget this, probably the most important thing for everybody out there who's fans of the slasher genre, Halloween 4 and 5 are being re-released by Anchor Bay in special Divimax versions.
We'll definitely have reviews of those fairly soon, hopefully.
Halloween, 25 Years of Terror, which we're going to mention.
And we're definitely going to review that here in a little bit.
Yeah, will also be released. So you, and I'm not shitting you. You got to pick those films up.
You got to pick them all up.
And what the hell's wrong with you people?
If you're a Halloween fan, you'll get all three of those discs.
Yeah, but those are the DVD releases for next week. And seriously, I would recommend all those Anchor Bay titles that I just mentioned.
And yeah, if you notice on the website, we have a list of the companies that we consider the best.
That's right. And we have Troma.
Yep.
Anchor Bay.
Yep.
Tartan.
Mm-hmm.
And Dark Sky.
That's right. In our humble opinion, those four are the companies to buy from, to support, if you will, because they release the best horror products going.
Yeah, that's right. Well, so if you want to check out some of their products, all four of those companies are listed on the front page of the website, Dead Pit. Check that out. But moving right along, I guess we should go ahead and get to the interview section of the show.
That's right.
We have an interview this week with the legendary producer and director and founder of Full Moon Entertainment, good old Uncle Charlie Band.
That's right. We talked to him extensively about his entire career. And what I thought was more interesting than anything about it was exactly how he got into distributing. You know, he's part of the media group, which released tons of stuff in the late 70s, early 80s, and also Wizard Video, which to this day remains a collectible item.
A lot of people don't know about Charles Band is he was one of the very first people in any genre to get into the VHS market.
That's right. And you'll learn about that. You'll learn anything you ever want to know about old Charlie Band.
I'm sure, because we got a lot of Full Moon fans on the board, though, that there'll be some questions we didn't ask about specific films. Please keep in mind that this guy's produced over 200 films.
That's right.
So it's impossible for us to ask him everything. So just take the interview as a whole, and for what it is, leave us the fuck alone!
Here's Charles Band on DeadPit.com.
What first got you interested in B-movies?
Well, I was lucky enough to grow up on a movie set. My dad made films. And he made films in the late 50s and early 60s. And, you know, he made spaghetti westerns and epics with Steve Reeves. And he also made some horror films. And he wasn't, you know, dedicated or specific to one genre, which I've been. But, you know, he did make, I guess they would still be considered B-movies. I mean, quite a few of them were released theatrically, just like some of my earlier films were. But, you know, it gets in your blood, and then I just took my love for the genre, you know, sci-fi and horror, mainly horror, and that's kind of what I've been doing. And it wasn't like a master plan. I just sort of, you know, I began making a few horror films and thought that was great and just stuck to a genre which has had, you know, good stretches and bad stretches. Never terrible. I mean, horror has always had, you know, some kind of a following. But now, of course, you know, we're inundated with so much horror, and whether it's small pictures or huge studio films, we've been sort of in a stretch now of lots and lots of horror films.
You talked about your father. What did he teach you about the filmmaking business or just about making movies in general?
Well, you know, he was a great father and passed away very recently, and he taught me, I think first and foremost, the temperament you need to deal with people who are artists who sometimes have pretty crazy mood swings, and, you know, to be somewhat, as a producer at least, to be somewhat of a diplomat and to, you know, just sort of the right approach, because at the end of the day, you know, everyone you know, wants to make a good movie, and, you know, no one sets out to make a bad one. That happens sometimes, but you really want to have the right spirit, even if it's a very, very small project. You know, talent sometimes emerges even when there's no money and, you know, a few shooting days, and suddenly you discover a, you know, a wonderful actor, actress who becomes a star, or you make a little movie that somehow hits a chord, and a lot of that is accomplished. I mean, you need the talent and you need all sorts of stuff, including some money, but if you don't have the right temperament for this business, if you're sort of running the ship, things usually don't work out so well. So I think the best lesson, and I learned this just from observation, is just the way he handled people, and he was just a real good, calm guy. From the practical side, though, he had me apprenticed doing just about everything on a movie set. So I really grew up doing some fun jobs and some not-so-fun jobs. You know, looking back, that was real valuable because most people who call the shots today, who are the producers or the executive producers, have never really, you know, really worked on a movie set and wouldn't have the slightest clue of how to do a lot of what it takes to make a movie. So the fact that I can do that, and, you know, if need be, and I have, sometimes I'll just jump in and do something because we don't, the person, I don't know, doesn't show up, or we don't have the money, and suddenly I'm doing a few extra chores. But, you know, practically he taught me a lot, certainly the mechanical side, but I think the most important lesson was just how to talk to people and deal with people, and, you know, and some good pointers on, you know, directing, which, you know, I do more and more now. I've always directed, but, you know, I've been sort of, you know, out of every seven or eight movies, I'll direct one over the last too many years to mention, and now I'm pretty much directing everything for a while.
Now, one of your first directorial efforts was Parasite from 1982.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
I was just curious how that came about and whose idea was it to cast Demi Moore?
Well, it was my idea. I mean, it was my idea as far as the title and the premise of the film.
Yeah.
As far as casting, what happens is it's not so much an idea that sort of, you know, where a casting choice emerges. It's just, you know, hopefully you have enough choice and you have good people. And then it's your taste, really. It's the taste of the director, sometimes the producer, who has, you know, in some cases, you know, more to say than the director. But generally speaking, you know, you have people who are brought in by the casting director, and you hopefully have the good taste to select the right ones. And when you're dealing with, you know, new people, ingenues, people who've had very little credit, I mean, it's one thing. I've never really had it, but it must be a luxury to have a $100 million budget and say, you know, Brad Pitt would be good for this and that. And you kind of just list all your favorite people who are all known quantities. When you're making small movies, you don't have that. So luckily, there's a tremendous amount of talent out there, and especially a lot of wonderful young actors in Hollywood. So you literally, you know, you have it's an open call to some degree. The casting director, usually weed out. So that's probably the wrong word, but they'll cull down the, you know, the people who are obviously not right for the part. So that if 200 people submit or are submitted by agents or directly submit their photos, and you know, maybe at the end of the day the director sees 20 of them, and then, you know, you usually have a couple of sessions. You bring back your top two or three. Sometimes you couple those with the, you know, the opposite character, or, you know, if it's a love interest, you'll take your two or three choices for the girl and for the guy, and you'll kind of put them together and see how they work and how the chemistry works. But at the end of the day, it really is like anything else, taste. You know, hopefully you have good enough taste to make the right choice.
During the late 70s, you produced several great films like Tourist Trap,
mm-hmm.
Laser Blast, which I think was lampooned by Mystery Science Theater.
Yeah, it sure was.
And a documentary called Auditions, kind of like
uh-huh.
a pseudo-documentary. What do you recall about those films and that period of time?
Yeah, I sometimes pretend, because I live in denial, that I was not alive back then. It sounds like so freaking long ago.
Yeah.
And my memory is not so great. But, you know, it's like there's no real difference. The difference, I guess, is that what you look forward to as far as hopefully making a few bucks to then go on and make your next movie was something that was very abstract today, which is film rentals. Back in the day, the only distribution outlet for these movies were theatrical. You were the B movie or the C movie on a double or triple bill, and you got a little money, and you made some prints, and you ran those prints around the country. And there was no video and no internet and no nothing. I mean, that was it. You know, there was no other source of revenue. Luckily, there was it was a little more of an even playing field back then, because the major studios weren't making big horror sci-fi movies. They were few and far between until Star Wars hit, and then things changed, but prior to Star Wars, it was a rare occasion when a major studio would make and release a horror film or a big sci-fi picture. So there was room because there were fans out there, and so I do remember, you know, just making choices and doing whatever I would do to try to make that theatrical experience as much as I could with, like, you know, a $2 budget, because, you know, it's unfortunately, you know, that's kind of what we did. I mean, I shot Laser Blast over 3 weekends, so
yeah,
very few days and very few dollars. But, you know, there was enough invention in there that it caught some little wave of something. People still talk about it. They, you know, I bump into a lot of people who are little kids and who, you know, saw that as one of their first movies and either were scared of the freaky guy turning more into an alien with his gun, or they were all happy that he was able to blow away his enemies. You know, they remember the little alien guys, you know, which were all done at that time, you know, with stop motion animation. So I have those kind of memories, but it's more about, you know, just how, by today's standards, strange it must have been, and I was there barely. I sort of caught the tail end of that because Roger Corman, who's,
yeah,
you know, a lot older than me, started many years before me. He was solid into to many years where, whether it was through AIP, he was making and releasing movies on 35, and that was his business. And then as he, I don't want to say wound down, but as he got older and, you know, the business changed, then he was video guy and whatever else. But I when I started, it was sort of the very end of that B, and that's why they're called B movies. The B movie was the bottom end of a double bill, you know,
yeah,
the B film. Today, B movies, it's almost a misnomer because today, especially when you sell films, anything that isn't a big theatrical release is a B movie. So, I mean, there should be a number of subcategories, which there aren't. But anyway, that's what I remember more than anything else, just going out there, shooting on 35, and knowing that at some point, even if it was just a small drive-in run in the Midwest or in the South, we would have either Tourist Trap or Laser Blast or Crash or one of these movies I made in the mid to late 70s. They would go out there and play in drive-ins, you know.
You kind of hinted at this. We were talking to Lloyd Kaufman from Troma the other day.
Uh-huh.
And he mentioned that you were way ahead of the curve in the VHS market. We were just curious, how did you discover that would be a viable thing during, you know, the early
days? I was just a fan, you know. I mean, way back before VHS, I had a collection of totally illegal copies of my favorite films. I shared the expense with a few other film collectors. So I had a whole bunch of movies on 3/4 inch back in the day. So the experience of actually being able to screen a movie for friends, you know, at my house, you know, it was, I mean, I've always been a film nut, so I mean, even before that I had 16mm prints, which was always expensive and a pain in the butt to screen, you know, it's just, you know, there was always problems, you had to thread it up and change reels, and, I mean, it was fun, and back then that was the only option. I mean, today, you know, people so don't know that there was a time not that long ago where, you know, nobody could watch a movie, you know, at will, let alone even find it anywhere. I mean, either you saw it late night on TV, and that was just the luck of the draw, you know, or if you were a real crazy collector with some money, you could go out and, you know, find a print, a 16mm print, usually, of a classic film. But today, we have access to tens of thousands of movies. It's all, like, there. It's at our fingertips, and it feels so normal. But back in those days, none of that existed. So I was a collector, and then I started putting movies, or with some friends, we would borrow, again, totally illegal, we would borrow prints from studios, and then run to a film chain and make a few 3/4 inch copies and split the cost. And at some point, I must have had 40 or 50 movies, you know, in my 3/4 inch library. And then I got wind of the first, it was not VHS, it was actually Beta. Mm-hmm. The first Betamax machine was coming out. And that sounded like a great idea. And then I got wind of a fellow who, at the same time as this machine was coming out, licensed 50 titles from 20th Century Fox. And his company was called Mag Video or Magnetic Video. And people were writing little articles in the trade saying the guy's crazy, that he thinks people are going to be buying these things for $50. No one's going to buy these movies for $50. You know, you can't watch a movie more than once or twice. It's a crazy idea. But I thought it was cool. And I was like the first guy to buy the first Betamax machine, which came out, which was in a huge wood console. This was back in the day where, you know, there was no option to buy a little deck. You had to buy this, like, huge Ben Cartwright, you know, console with wood and carving and a big tube TV. And in there was, of course, your Beta machine. And then back at that time, I just thought, well, you know, if this guy can do it with Fox, I don't have those dollars. Let me go out and buy or license little independent successful movies, which I did. So in 1977, I started what was the first independent video company called Media Home Entertainment. And I licensed movies like Tunnel Vision and The Groove Tube and a little later on Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Halloween and I Spit on Your Grave and just a bunch of weird, you know, successful cult movies at the time. And, yeah, so I was there in the early, early days of video, which was fun. It was crazy. And then, of course, it caught fire and, you know, we're all... Actually, it's ironic that today we're sitting in a space where that era is really over. I mean, even though DVDs are all over the place, the experience of a DVD and renting a DVD and having to return it or stick it back in the mail, that's in a heartbeat going to be gone. It's all going to be a digital download. It's all going to be a different delivery system, and that's literally around the corner. I mean, there'll be collectors just like there's still people collecting Laserdiscs, but, you know, when you can just, you know, dial up into a Universal horror film, see what you like, pay a couple bucks, and either, you know, burn it on your computer, burn a DVD, or just watch it. I mean, no one's going to be going back to the store anymore.
Yeah.
So that era is actually almost over.
Yeah, the Wizard videos, though, they seem to, they're still collector's items.
Like, I know.
On eBay, you can see them, and they go for outrageous amounts. I was just curious what you thought of that.
Yeah. That's true, yeah. That was another label. I mean, my first label was Media Home Entertainment. Then in 1980, I started Wizard, and it also had a bunch of crazy cult films from Lucio Fulci films.
Yeah.
I mean, there was just all sorts of strange movies on the Wizard label.
Most people know you from Full Moon Entertainment. At what point did that company form?
Full Moon formed in 1990. Prior to that, I had a company called Empire, which is my only other, the only other company that I had for some stretch of time. And we made movies like Reanimator and From Beyond and Dolls and Ghoulies and all sorts of fun movies in the early to mid-80s. And then I started Full Moon. The first movie was Puppet Master.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early days, I had a deal with Paramount. They were the distributor. That turned out to be not a good thing. So I eventually, you know, escaped with my life barely and took the label, you know, on my own. And, you know, for better or for worse, I've tried over the years to keep making, you know, these films. And had a couple bad years where the business changed so radically we couldn't even get on the store shelves just because that's what happens sometimes. And now things are turning for the better. There's an internet business, which is, you know, promising. The fans are out there, which is great. You know, I've been doing a lot of conventions. I do a road show. Now this will be my second year, mid-September through mid-October. I'm going to do 21 cities and just take a bunch of fun stuff on the road, kind of a demented Ozfest. It's the only way I can think of really getting to the fans, because otherwise, you know, we're in a world where I can't buy media. I mean, not for these little movies. So, you know, going out, there's like a band going on the road, really, you know, and I'll be, it's a very fun show. I mean, it's a bit of everything. It's a bit Barnum and Bailey. We show crazy clips. We do interactive stuff on the stage. I have guest celebrities, sell merchandise. This year I'm going to be cutting heads off because I got a huge 8-foot guillotine I'm bringing with me. So, you know, it's a little bit of everything to, you know, just to do something different and to connect with the people who love these movies.
Just out of curiosity, because Will Kaufman talked about this yesterday as well, do you think that the huge business conglomerates are trying to push the smaller independent companies out of business?
You know, I don't think anyone is consciously doing anything. I'm not in that frame of mind. I'm not like paranoid guy and there's some big wig guy up there trying to figure out how to crush Full Moon or Troma. I think that's silly.
Yeah.
But I think unfortunately, it's what happens with consolidation and, you know, with the clout that these studios have. I mean, there was a time in the early days of video where there were tens of thousands of video stores and there were distributors who got to those stores and the stores were really anxious to put everyone's product on the shelf. Now those stores are all but gone and they've been bought up and now you got three or four customers. You know, you have Blockbuster and Movie Gallery and Hollywood Video, and of course Hollywood and Movie Gallery are now one. So, you know, at the end of the day, when there are just three or four buyers that can make or break you as far as a movie, and those guys are all getting beat up by the major studios because they want them to put 8 billion copies of their movie on the shelves. You know, they have $3 left at the end of their open to buy for, you know, 200 independent movies. And that's what happens. So it's not, I think, an evil plot. It's just what happens when things consolidate and things get, you know, kind of the way they are. Now, I'm hoping that the whole digital world, which is opening up, will even out that playing field a bit again, because then it seems to me it doesn't matter who's got the clout. If as long as people have access to menus and lists and the people who are going to provide programming, and those people, their incentive will always be to give as much breadth of choice as possible, I don't think that particular medium is going to hurt an independent, whereas video stores, I mean, I know the guys who buy for those stores, they have so much money and there's so little left after they've had to buy or force buy the major product, they just have to make a choice and they'll pick up six or eight independent movies out of maybe 200 that are submitted. In the digital delivery world, I don't think that's going to be an issue because it'll be there. You know, then it's just, you know, does the customer want to look at Puppet Master 18 or not, you know?
Yeah. But during that the period of time when Full Moon was at its peak, you had lots of different franchises like Trancers and,
sure,
and Puppet Master. And,
mm-hmm,
and you mentioned working with Stuart Gordon, too,
sure,
on a bunch of different films. I was just curious as to what produced the idea for Puppet Master, and was it in any way influenced by Dolls, which was
Jaws?
No. You mean Dolls, the movie I made with Stuart?
Yeah.
Not really. I wanted to, I mean, I came up with both of those ideas. And again, you know, there are all sorts of predecessor movies, so there's nothing really new under the sun. I was really influenced, for Dolls, what influenced me a lot was the Karen Black episode of Trilogy of Terror.
Oh, yeah.
And that's kind of what inspired Dolls. Puppet Master, I always wanted to make a movie with sort of superhero, or it started off supervillain, little puppets that all had these little powers or these different. I mean, I had sketches for years of these. I mean, I didn't have the title Puppet Master, but I had sketches for years of what these characters could do and what they would look like. And then it all made sense one day, and I came up with the title and started working with an artist to sort of put together the right combination of a bunch of these little characters that I had, you know, sketched out over the years. And then the idea of making it a World War II, you know, 1940s era piece seemed appealing, so that the puppets would have sort of a retro feel, and that's kind of it all began actually with a piece of art, as most of these movies begin, and the title.
I was always curious how difficult it was to shoot the dolls and to make them come alive for the movie.
It's not easy. There's so many different technologies, and back in the day of Dolls, we had more money, and I was involved with a wonderful stop-motion animation, a special effects guy who has also left us a few years ago, a guy named David Allen. And, you know, so much of this is money-driven. I mean, in the perfect world, you'd have all sorts of shots that are animated so the puppets can jump around and do things you can't do if they're, let's say, rod puppets. But I'm a big believer in organic effects. I mean, wherever possible, I'd like to actually build and have the puppet, the doll, the creature in the room, on the desk, in the environment. The whole notion of a cartoon or a CGI character, you know, sort of illustrated. I mean, that works too. I mean, obviously, if you have tons and tons of money, you can do Jurassic Park and the dinosaurs look amazing. But, you know, that's in a different realm. And even on the bigger movies, even on the biggest movies, you know, we're all pretty good at this. We're jaded. We see all these big films. I mean, so often you'll see something that looks like a cartoon. You're going, oh, that's obviously a computer shot. And that's with all the money in the world. I mean, one of my favorite movies in recent years is Gladiator. I love that film.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's some scenes in the Colosseum where he's fighting the lions or the tigers or whatever they were, and yeah, they look cartoony. They just don't move because they're rendered in a computer. So I like these organic effects. So as much as I can, we do stuff on set. And they're usually rod puppets today, which can move pretty cool, and then you can then, in the computer, take out the rods, paint out the rods, so suddenly you've got an animated little ginger dead man or a doll or some freaky little character jumping on a desk, you know.
How do you feel about the mainstream movies that come out, just in general, not just horror, but it seems like they're all rehashes of something that happened.
Yeah, they are. I mean, you know, when an original idea, when something comes out that's original and it's well made, which happens, it's such a joy. I mean, you go, oh my God, that was so cool, because you see something. I mean, Hollywood can still make an amazing event movie if everything's lined up correctly. But all the stuff that's basically remakes or sequels or derivative of something else, and, you know, and all these movies where they spend a ton of money on effects and everyone forgets about character and story. I mean, you know, I'm a big Dracula fan, and I love Coppola's Dracula. It may have had its flaws, but as a movie, I mean, he's an amazing director, and it had a great vibe. So I was really looking forward to Van Helsing, because the spots, the trailers at the time, the TV spots, looked amazing. I thought, whoa, this has got to be great. And the movie was such a sucky movie.
Yeah, it really was.
And they spent $150 million. I mean, I can make movies for all eternity with that money.
Yeah.
You know, and why? Because they just forgot about character and story. So, you know, once in a while a great movie comes along and you just think, wow, that was really a great experience. But for the most part, you know, it's the same old deal. And all these remakes of 80s horror films are, I mean, there's some exceptions, but for the most part, they're all slick. They kind of look like MTV made them all. They just don't have that gritty realism that sometimes made the originals really scary, because it kind of felt like that's a girl who really was a girl that maybe lived next door to you. It wasn't some, you know, some sort of fake Hollywood chick, you know.
Yeah. On the opposite end of that spectrum, I've also heard that you're not a big fan of the digital video that has become so popular that a lot of independent filmmakers use.
It has its place. You know, if you're Robert Rodriguez and you have tens of millions of dollars to make a cool movie, you can make an amazing movie on digital video.
Yeah.
But on the low-budget arena, I mean, it's true. You know, the price of admission now is nothing. You can buy a little camera. I mean, you know, with a few bucks, you can be a filmmaker and actually go and burn some DVDs and create a piece of art. And it's like, wow, that's kind of cool. But I just think, with exceptions, few exceptions, the look is not the look of a movie. It's the look of something else. And you just can't beat the – I mean, it's really hard on these budgets to make a picture in 35, but
yeah,
that's something I'm still trying to do, so that, you know, whether you like the movie or not, it still feels like you're looking at a movie and not a, you know, a soap opera.
I always thought the digital video looked way too processed and just generic. I don't
know. It does. And they're coming up with new ways and chips to make it look less that way, but for me at least we could save a lot of money by not doing film. I'm happier, you know, making other sacrifices and having that film look, because that, I think, makes a difference.
Yeah. You briefly touched on the film deal with Paramount, and I think the question that we got the most here was what happened with the whole Puppet Master box set that came out.
That's so funny. Yeah, that's such a stupid, like, I mean, I don't want to categorize it as stupid, but it's almost the silliest story in the world. Make a long story short, we thought that we had the DVD rights on our early films, because when I made the deal with Paramount, we did in fact have the Laserdisc rights. And even though it was sort of unwritten in the document, our interpretation and our attorney's interpretation was Paramount clearly had and still has the video rights, the VHS rights, but we retained the Laserdisc rights, which kind of meant we shouldn't be having the DVD rights, which again was not even addressed back in 1990 or whatever the deal was. We then, at the time, sublicensed a few of the titles to a company that we had nothing to do with, a company called Koch. They started releasing some of the earlier Full Moon films, including the famous box set. Everyone got a cease and desist letter from Paramount. This is some years ago. And they basically said, we you know, lay claim to these rights, and you know, we'll fight, we'll go, we'll sue, we'll take you to court. And my judgment call at the time was just, you know, I don't want to be, I mean, it was bad enough trying to get out of the clutches of Paramount. And I just didn't want to, you know, be going to court every other day and fighting a big old fight. So I went to this distributor and I said, look, we have plenty of other movies to release that Paramount has no claim to. Let's just stop selling the stuff, which we did. And this is back some years ago. And then not too long ago, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 months ago, we had a huge warehouse with a lot of film and prints and negative, and we were moving stuff around trying to get rid of stuff. And we found that back in the day, we had originally received, you know, sort of our allotment of DVDs, not just the box sets, but also a bunch of some of the other ones that were discontinued, like a movie I made called Crash and Burn and Pit and the Pendulum. So yeah, I mean, it was sort of like that lost little, you know, cachet or whatever the word is, and that was it, basically. And then, you know, those are all gone now. I mean, I have a few left. We take them to conventions. I mean, we never went out and sold them at retail because they're sort of like lost and forgotten. But those rights are really held by Paramount, or at least we're not going to fight them on their claim.
So,
and, you know, and one day they may release it, or who knows? I don't think they're thinking about it. I don't think they'll ever release it. So it's sort of unfortunate. But it sort of relates to about 30 of my several hundred titles that Paramount has or claims to have those rights.
There was more than a few films that you were uncredited as a producer, like just for example, Intruder and Breeders.
Correct.
You know, what was the reason behind that, if any?
You know, it was, in retrospect, it was a stupid reason. I just, you know, I wasn't credit hungry. I even at that time, I had made 100, 150 movies, and you know, I was the distributor. I financed it. I helped make the movie. There's still movies that I own. I mean, we just released Intruder not too long ago, the director's cut. But at the time, I never thought it was important to necessarily have yet another credit on a movie, so I just didn't take it. You know, it wasn't anything more than that. Now, you know, there's probably 30 movies, I think. I was looking around trying to figure out how many movies have I been involved in making, and I did not take credit. And I think it's about 30, and that's definitely Intruder is one of them.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't even put my credit on Reanimator, which was definitely a mistake, and I was, my dad and I both clearly were, you know, co-producers. We were involved in the whole, you know, the inception, the editing. We got rid of, we helped the producer at the time, Brian and Stewart, get a new crew because they shot a few days on Reanimator and material didn't look good. So we kind of put our A crew in at that time. We were very involved in the editing and post-production. Clearly, and it would have been easy just to say, listen, we should get some sort of a co-producer, executive producer credit. But it's just, it was not like, didn't really mean anything at the time.
Yeah, you have a special thanks on the film, and we never could exactly figure out why, but I guess that explains it then.
Yeah.
On Reanimator.
Yeah.
I was just curious about the circumstances behind the end of Full Moon Entertainment and why you decided to change the name back to Wizard, I guess.
Well, Full Moon is still the label, even though Wizard is the new company that's financing these films, and I have a wonderful new partner. But, I mean, the pictures still say Full Moon Features. I mean, I probably should have kept Wizard even smaller on the box so nobody would be asking that question, because I just like to know or be known as, you know, Charlie Vance, you know, continue to make Full Moon films.
Yeah.
That's the fact that it's not Full Moon Entertainment, but it's Full Moon Features, and it's just a label of Wizard. You know, it's almost like, you know, I mean, Paramount isn't really Paramount anymore. It's Viacom, but people know Paramount as a label. So not to make the comparison, that's silly, but, you know, we'll make Full Moon more and more prominent on the boxes so people know that it's still my label and the label that I'm most, you know, associated with. But technically, it is a new company with a new funding partner, and the movies are being made by Wizard.
So how do you think that your films have changed since the 80s?
Well, man, that's a good question. I would say the short answer, and it's only because I've got actually someone waiting here, but the short answer is, the movies are, we have less money, ironically, to make movies than we did 20 years ago. 20 years ago, video was booming, and we simply had more money and more time and more days to shoot. And today, with the way things have gone, we have less of everything. So, you know, you keep trying to be inventive. You keep trying to stretch the dollar and find ways to still make a clever little film. So they're, you know, they have a little less bang for the buck. They're a little more character story driven. There's less effects. There's less running time. That's, you know, part of it. So, and hopefully as the business gets a little better for us and the digital deal begins to kick in, we'll have a few more bucks to, you know, add some more days and tackle some more ambitious projects. I mean, there were films I made in the 80s that were, for small movies, pretty damn ambitious, you know, whether it was Robot Wars or pictures that involved, you know, a lot of action or big giant robots and, or, you know, all the subspecies movies I made in Transylvania, Romania. These were pictures that, you know, required taking 20 people and putting them up for 6 weeks, albeit in an inexpensive place to shoot. But still, those budgets are way more than what we're spending now. But as a result, we have these very beautiful, you know, movies. I mean, aside from the fact that I'm real happy about Subspecies as a series, they're also very well made because we shot, you know, for 5 or 6 weeks on each film. And today we're usually shooting a week and a half. That's how quickly, you know, we're having to make the films today. So I think that the biggest difference between the 80s and now is we had more money and the pictures were a little more big idea, sort of ambitious, and I'm sure that will kind of turn around again.
Well, since you're pressed for time, I guess I'll just ask about future projects, and everybody always wants to know if there'll be another, you know, Trancers movie or Subspecies
sure.
movie. Or
well, I'm there's so much going on. I mean, I just finished a movie called The Evil Bong.
Yeah, we heard about that.
Which is pretty out there, and I'm real happy with it. I would have to say it's my first sort of comedy. It's more of a horror stoner comedy, and it's got some horror elements in it, but it's a lot of fun, and I think it turned out well, and I think it's going to be sort of my little shop of horrors, because it's got that vibe going, and that's fun. That's coming out just before Halloween, and I have a movie I'm starting in a few weeks called Dead Man's Hand, and Bill Moseley's the star, one of the stars. He's the guy from House of a Thousand Corpses and Devil's Rejects. And Dead Man's Hand is about a haunted casino, so it's a good script and I think a pretty fresh idea. And there's some sequels coming up. For sure. I'm going to make a sequel to Doll Man, another Doll Man adventure with Tim Thomerson, who is perfect for that. I don't think we're doing Trancers anymore. I think that kind of, I think we did a bunch of those, and I think Tim, I can't see doing it with anyone else, and Tim is, I hate to say he's too old because he's still in amazing shape, but I don't see him as Jack Death anymore. But as Doll Man, he's just perfect, and we talked about doing a Doll Man. I'm going to do a sequel to Dr. Mordred. I made one of those back in the early 90s with Jeffrey Combs.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go back and do those. I'll definitely make another Puppet Master, a real good one, sometime next year. Okay. Again, those films are a little more ambitious, but I'm looking forward to doing that.
Okay.
And try to mix up new things with, you know, some sequels to some of the ones that people are familiar with. I'm doing The Roadshow, which is totally a lot of fun, and I'm not sure how near I'll be to you guys, but... I'm sure there's some city in the 21 that's not too far from people who may be listening to this program. And, you know, they just go to my blog, charlesband.com. All the cities are listed in the dates. And that's a lot of fun. That's sort of unique, and no one else is doing that that I know of because I've made so many horror films. I guess I'm uniquely suited to get up there and have some fun with it because of the genre that I've dedicated myself to. And that's a fun show. That turned out to be a cool thing. And I still do the conventions. I try to do 8 or 10 conventions a year just, again, to meet people and, you know, just sort of, and also to listen to what people are looking forward to seeing. I mean, I'm, you know, I've got a lot of ideas, but some of the better ideas, or at least directions, come from fans who just come up with the craziest stuff, and then I think, wow, that's kind of cool.
I'm Amy Lynn Best, and you're listening to Dead Pit Radio.
Welcome back to DeadPit.com. I am the Creepy Kentuckian.
Howdy, I'm a Bill.
Hope you all enjoyed the hell out of the Charles Band interview. I'm sure you did.
It was just a real honor to be able to interview somebody that's done that many different types of horror films.
Been that involved in horror since the 70s, really.
Yeah, him along with Lloyd Kaufman, I mean, were just amazing people to interview about the business of horror.
Yeah. So, we got a lot of fan questions to get to.
Yeah, I guess we should start with one from a guy by the name of Chemical Caligula.
That's right.
From the board, who gives us this question. Was wondering what you guys do for a living, and I was wondering if you like the post-apocalyptic genre,
mm-hmm.
if you have some favorites. And if you have the chance to pick a kill in a horror scenario, a director or anyone involved in the genre, who would it be and how? That's kind of odd to read that, but I think what he's saying is if we could kill a director from the horror genre, how would we do it? And so, first of all, what is it that we do for a living is the first question.
Well, we really tried to avoid this because I know a lot of people on the board probably wouldn't understand, but I work in the coal mines.
Yeah, he's a miner for a strip mine, right?
Yeah, that's what I do right now. So, but I'm also trained in jiu-jitsu, and I'm a web designer and a graphic artist. And a tattoo artist, and, you know, I do all kinds of shit.
And me personally, I work as a custodian for the Prestonburg Elementary School.
Right, yeah.
That's like seeing that shot out. I don't really do anything else. I just custode.
Clean out shit. Kids.
I clean toilets and staircases and pretty much anything that has surfaces.
And you show little kids your balls.
And I do. Yeah. I show them my balls and my hairy ass. I like to do that. Especially.
And do they still use that pink sawdust shit to clean up puke?
I do, except I got a special gold sawdust that I like to use because of my addiction to gold spray paint.
Okay. There you go, though. There's that answer to that question.
And, well, actually, there's four different parts of this question.
Okay.
The second part is if you like the post-apocalyptic genre of horror films.
Oh, God, I didn't know there was a genre of that.
There's a couple of films I could think of, like Road Warrior-style films, you know, where they have, like, the end of the world. 28 Days Later is one.
Hell Comes to Frog Town.
Yeah, that's another one, too.
That movie sucked.
It did, but it was kind of funny how much, like, Jared really liked that movie.
I don't know, man. I guess you could probably link one of them Terminator movies like that, Terminator 2.
Well, they all had, like, flashbacks of that in them, but I don't know.
Let's see.
Apparently, we're not big fans of the genre. If we can't
I can't really think of many, so the answer's probably no.
And if we had the chance to pick a horror film death for a director.
I've got one in my mind right now.
Go ahead.
All right. Do you remember Chief Woodenhead from Creepshow?
Of course, yeah.
I would prefer him to scalp Eli Roth.
That would be... That'd be a good one because he'd have like all those little spots.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. He'd grab the spot there and just scalp him.
Here's what I would think. I'd like in my horror film for someone to beat Paul W.S. Anderson to death with a fucking regular NES console.
Yeah. Because you know that he's probably allergic to the old video game system. He's like, the graphics don't look great on that, like, Alien versus Predator on
PlayStation
2.
Since he's getting ready to do Castlevania, I figured that would only be fitting.
Yeah.
You know, just while Super Mario Bros. Theme was playing.
You could stick an original Castlevania cartridge up his ass.
Yeah, and shut his asshole together and see if he'd play. Okay. What else we got?
We got something from Coroner, who's a rather new member on the message board. Hey, Uncle Bill in Creepy Kentucky, and thanks for reading my question last week. And a lot of your shows, you pan remakes for not being original enough. My question is, what is the most original horror movie you have ever seen? And second, since Charles Band will be your guest, what is your favorite band-produced film?
Well, let's answer the second question first. My favorite band-produced film is a film that not a lot of people know about, but it's called Intruder.
That's right.
And it was I believe it was Scott Spiegel.
Yeah. Okay. And both of the Raimis was in. I think it's one of Sam Raimi's only acting roles.
And they both get killed, which is amazing, too.
Yeah. And Bruce Campbell's in it for like 2 seconds.
Yeah. But it was one of KMB's first attempts.
It was KMB's first
as
a group, as KMB.
And it really shows because it has some killer makeup effects in it.
I'm going to go ahead and say Reanimator. And that's one movie that somebody will try to email me and say, no, he didn't. Yes, he did. He just said so in the interview.
He didn't listen to the interview.
Uncredited producer in that movie. So there you go.
The first part of the question was, I think this kind of misses the point, but it says, what was the most original horror film you've ever seen? There's tons of stuff that was original. Like you could say.
I think what we should say, because we'd be thinking about this forever. Why don't we say the best original film in the past 6 years?
Shit, I don't even know then. I'll just say this. Okay.
That'd be easier.
Night of Living Dead, to me, is an original horror film because it took a subject like zombies. Zombies have been around in horror films before then. You know, like Astro Zombies, I think, was around before then. And, you know, White Zombie, the original. But they had never been cannibals and they had never been that type of film. So that, to me, is an original concept. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, to me, is an original concept because that kind of snuff film look of a horror film had never been done before. So that, to me... Now, if I said Halloween, somebody would go, oh, shit, what about Black Christmas? So,
well, here's your one for the slasher genre. Psycho.
Yeah.
It's probably the first slasher movie, or you consider it halfway slasher. Over the past... I don't know, 6 years, though, I'd have to say one movie that I thought was really original and damn good that people do talk about it, I guess, now is Lucky McKee's May. I thought that was a killer one.
Well, I mean, over the past 6 years, The Sixth Sense, in a way, was original with the way it was filmed. And also Blair Witch, I guess that would probably...
Although it did sort of lift some shit from Cannibal Holocaust.
Yeah,
same
with
sort of
the film. Yeah. When we say, okay, let me explain this. Any film, to me, is more original than a remake. Any type of film that you do, even if you rip somebody off inadvertently, to me is better than a remake. Because with a remake, you're just basically coming out and saying, we couldn't think of anything original enough, so we're going to remake some fucking films that have already been done just to make money.
Well, I think a lot of that has to do with the studio, too. They just are scared to release something original. And I guess they should be, because... When Slither came out, it bombed. They only brought in like $3 million. And the movie-going audience right now is fairly stupid, actually. because you got to look at a movie like Little Man that was released last weekend, and it made $21 million.
I just think, I'm not so sure if everybody's stupid or not, but I do think that most people that go to the movies have basically been programmed to accept, like, less from films than they used to. Yep. And that's why you go, they don't give a shit that they're getting fed this crap that's horrible now.
Yeah.
Just my opinion.
Going off topic, I probably would just, I just wanted to mention this. People often talk about, and I'm not a big fan of the old style of movie making or anything. People, just for instance, mainstream movies compare Brad Pitt with James Dean a lot, right?
I'm sure they do, but I haven't paid attention.
I don't know if you've seen many like James Dean movies. There's only like three of them.
I think I've seen Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah. That motherfucker could really act. Brad Pitt can't act. That's the difference.
That is true, though. I don't know. Something I was noticing, though, that's along the same lines when I was watching that Halloween 25 Years of Terror in the panel thing, though. If you look at the people that were in the original Halloween and what the way that they, you know, talk about, and you go and look at the people that were even in, like, Halloween 6, those people that were in the original Halloween were real fucking actors.
Yeah.
Like, they'd actually studied acting and, like, knew the craft and had gone to school for it. And after a while, you know, you'll notice in horror films that it just became a kind of lowly kind of genre that anybody could wander on if you were a model and didn't have any kind of...
It's like that with everything now. Like, whereas even like 10 or 11 years ago, there were actors that people would, you know, everybody would agree that they were great actors. Now you've got motherfuckers, Owen Wilson and Vince Vaughn and Ben Stiller. I don't know. You could go on and on with these motherfuckers.
Yeah, but the point is that I not only have the audiences changed, but the talent.
Yeah, there's no talent.
Has changed as well.
Yeah, which is, we got another question here in a minute that people will be really amazed at, but we'll answer it.
But I guess we should go on with the questions.
Yes, sir.
Next question comes to us from Porkerface.
Porkerface!
Who says, do you think goofy mixed genre movies like Transylvania 65,000 hurt or help the horror genre?
They came out. I don't think it hurt or helped either one.
Yeah. You'd have to be like, it'd have to be a slew of films like Scary Movie, the Scary Movie films. I'm not entirely sure if that helped anything, but then again, you know, I don't think it hurt that much. If you're a real
honestly,
fan,
if I was,
hurt.
If I had to pick one or the other as far as the Scary Movie stuff go, I would say it might have helped, because how much longer would we have had those Scream ripoff type movies if that had not come out? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's true. But I can remember when I was a kid, though, the type of films that you're talking about, and there's one called Transylvania Twist. It had Angus Scrim in it.
Right.
And at the time when I was a kid, I just thought it was great to see him in something else besides Phantasm, so I wasn't really upset. It didn't rock my world or anything about hurting the horror genre.
Yeah, I don't think it does.
But also, do you think that, Freddy Krueger ever forgot that he was wearing his glove while experiencing a little jock itch and accidentally punctured his scrotum while scratching his balls with his right hand?
Well, I'm guessing that Freddy's balls probably looked like a burn up piece of bacon or something. So I doubt that his glove would affect his balls in any way. That's just
his balls were probably, I'm guessing, dissolved in the huge fire that also killed
him. They'd just be burned up.
Yeah. So there's the answer to this question.
Here's another one from Magic Fan 7687.
Magic Fan Niner 2147.
What's y'all's top overrated horror film of all time and underrated film of all time? If y'all have already answered this question, probably so, then what's love got to do with it?
I don't know. What's love anyway but a secondhand emotion?
Yeah.
What do you think for overrated? Because I'm sitting there trying to think.
Most overrated film. It would have to be something over the past couple of years, because my memory span isn't that accurate.
Well, we always talk about, me and you both agree on this to some extent. I think you even hate this movie more than I do, but Saw.
Yeah. Yeah. It's overrated. The whole series is overrated. And it's not really horror.
Yeah. I would definitely say that, to some extent, Blair Witch was overrated.
It was definitely overrated when it came out.
Yeah. But that's the only ones I can think of.
Recently. Underrated.
Underrated horror films. God, there's a ton of them, though.
Yeah.
But my two that I always try to mention on here as often as I can, and I'm sure people notice how much I mention them, are always going to be Blood Diner and Night of the Creeps. Those are two films that I think either one of them should be at least mentioned.
Yeah. Well, if you go back that far, hell, there's all kinds that you can mention. I really love the film Just Before Dawn.
Yeah.
Jeff Lieberman did that. Well,
you mentioned May.
We just recently saw that, yeah, and May's another one. Stir of Echoes is another one that nobody
got eclipsed by Sixth Sense because it came out at the same time. Yeah.
So there's a few for you if you haven't seen those. And he also liked to hear CK and Uncle Bill go at it in one-on-one in a freestyle rap battle, 8 Mile style.
Well, see, the only problem with that is that we're white and from Kentucky, so
yeah.
I don't think we rap. Maybe we should do like a banjo duel. Like
I know what we probably could do. We're good friends with Sticky Fingers.
That's right.
And we could set up a rap battle between Sticky Fingers and maybe get another one of his members from the Fingers Coalition.
Mm-hmm.
And they could do a rap battle about horror at some point.
Yeah, he's got the Five Fingers of Death posse.
Yeah.
That I know, you know. He's real good friends with. We could have all them come in and we could have like a throwdown.
Yeah, I know his good friend, Five Knuckle Shuffle.
Mm-hmm.
He's a pretty good rapper, too. I mean, I'm not a big fan of rap, but, you know, Sticky's the best.
Yeah.
Comes that.
And I think we'll need a tourniquet. Yeah. And anyway, moving on with questions. This comes to us from Franco Stein.
Okay.
Care of the message board. And he says, hey, guys, great show last week. My question is, if you could direct a horror film, what dream team of actors and actresses would you cast?
Okay.
Here's my deal with that. I think I've answered this question before. Dream teams don't work. All my favorite horror films have always been with actors that nobody knew the hell they were when the film was made.
Yeah, that's how mine would be.
So I wouldn't have a dream team because if I had to like pick people like Angelina Jolie and shit, I'm sure the film wouldn't work.
Yeah, I'd pick, I think we answered something along the lines of Friday the 13th, wasn't it? Who we'd pick for a Friday the 13th film. I'd probably pick actors and actresses that I thought really good in the independent world. Like, I love looking at Melantha Blackthorne.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I really love looking at
True.
Tiffany Shepis.
True.
So I'd cast both of them.
Word.
I don't know. There's a few more hot women out there that we would cast. Misty Monday, I'd hire her.
Yeah.
I wouldn't worry about what the movie was about. I'd just watch them. Like, I'd tell them, you know, where close to nothing.
As far as directors go, now that could be a different story because there's a lot of horror film directors that I would like to get back to do movies, like Kevin S. Teeny.
Yeah.
I'd love to see somebody like or Fred Decker even come back.
I think Kevin Teeny's working on something. We posted on the board.
Yeah.
So we can look forward to that. From Evil Dead 2, which is
The Wrath of Evil Dead.
A great movie. Hey, guys, I found your show through Arrow in the Head, who we'd really like to thank, by the way, for posting that last
show. If y'all don't know this, we've got a thing up for Sid Haig's show on Arrow in the Head, and you can check that out by going over to, I think you can go by arrowinthehead.com or joeblow.com/arrow.
Yeah. He mentioned, I think the show kicks ass. It's good to see that there's guys out there that like their horror movies with balls.
Put your balls to the wall, man.
I have three questions for you guys. Besides just saying he's shitty or his movies suck, what's your biggest gripe against Eli Roth? You guys talk about the lack of gore and tits in modern horror. Roth seems to fill your requirements of a good horror movie. Or is it just the fact that it's mainstream?
No.
There's a lot of mainstream movies out there that we enjoy. I think the problem with Eli Roth more than anything is he really doesn't know what he's doing as far as directing goes.
Yeah.
He's probably one of the most like nauseating directors to watch because all of the characters in his movie, you might as well just have cardboard stand-ups
mm-hmm.
out there. I don't know, man. It's hard to explain because...
Well, we've probably answered this question more than any other question.
Yeah, but the base, like, okay.
And here's the deal. He's just shitty.
I mean, that's the best way, because that, when we watch it, I just can't believe that other people can't see that it's bad. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you walked into a, you know, I don't know, just say a shit-filled bathroom, and it smelled like shit, I would be going, oh, God, this stinks, you know? But for some reason, there's people out there that believe the hype, that for some reason, it doesn't matter how bad the movie is.
But, okay, for some reason, like those dickholes at Deadlander, we have to, like, provide evidence for the shit that we want to claim on here. So let me just give, like, a brief rundown, okay? No character development.
That's the biggest problem.
Yeah. Really bad camera work.
Yeah.
No original music worth shit. There's very little gore for as much as people want to hype that movie up.
Yeah, Hostel, not that gory. Okay. Really not.
Bad writing. A horrible script. Ripping off all kinds of different films. I don't know. That's about why I think that he's a bad director.
He's shitty.
Yeah.
That's the best way to say it.
And I'm sure there's other parts of this question, though, I think.
Oh, yeah. He mentioned, have you guys seen The Darkness, the vampire version? Haven't seen it myself, but I was wondering what you guys thought of it before I bought it. I haven't seen it, I haven't heard of it.
I have heard of it because I was reading something about it the other night, but I haven't seen it either.
Okay. He wants to know our three favorite horror movies. Okay. Halloween, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Phantasm.
Well, good. At least we'll have one that's different. Because mine will be Dawn of the Dead, Halloween, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
I know you'd pick Dawn of the Dead. That's why I didn't.
Yeah. See, I just don't see how anybody couldn't like those three movies. I couldn't put those in the like, top three.
What about my three?
The only one different is Phantasm. That'd probably be like my top at least 10.
Yeah. But if you haven't seen those movies, you're crazy.
What the hell you listen to this show for if you haven't seen any of them?
I got something from Wes over at Unholy 3 Productions.
Of course.
He mentioned that I listened to the Sid Haig show, and it was great. I think it's awesome that you guys are from Kentucky and doing something this great. Keep it up. If I ever make a movie that has a chance of being released, I'll shoot you guys an invite to come to Louisville and cover it.
Hmm.
If it's a zombie flick, I'll make sure we get you into makeup. And like I was saying before, Uncle Bill and myself are both trained actors. We went to we go to acting school every day after I get out of the coal mine and he gets out of the...
When school lets out. Yeah.
We go and take acting lessons. So if you want to hire us and you're in the Kentucky area, we're available.
Just give us, drop us an email and tell us. But I would really like to be a zombie one time in a zombie film, and preferably like to be killed, involved in some sort of death scene.
That's right. Actually, we need to get some audio stuff because we had some contests last week. I played an audio clip on the show, and a few people got it right, but only one person got it right and won because it was the first person that answered the question correctly won the two DVDs. Eric Kent is the winner of that. And
by the way, you got to tell them what the clip was from.
Yeah, it was from Sorority Babes and the Slime Ball Bolarama. And after our break, we're going to have a trivia question. And the first person that gets that wins more DVDs from Zenon Pictures and DeadPit.com. But also, I had tarot cards to give away. Okay, well, I thought it would be a pretty cool idea for a contest. Really didn't turn into a contest because for some reason people just couldn't, either they couldn't find out where to record the promo or they didn't have the...
Or they just don't like us.
Yeah, or they don't like us or what. We only had two people send us in stuff. So both of you guys, Adam Beck and Donnie Miller, we're going to send you both two packs of tarot cards each since you're the only motherfuckers that sent us stuff. So we're going to play both of the promos right now here on Dead Pitch.
Dead Kim.
It's Friday, and you know what that means.
Carpet Day!
Huh?
No!
So after you take out the trash, come back in, sit down, and relax. And prepare yourself for a brand new episode of the Dead Pit Horror Radio Show, hosted by the Creepy Kentuckian and Uncle Bill, only on DeadPit.com, if you will.
Welcome to DeadPit.com. Hello, folks, I'm Uncle Bill, and I am the Creepy Kentuckian, if you will. Don't miss the Dead Pit Boys being interviewed on the Oprah Winfrey Show this upcoming Wednesday. That's right, folks. We will be discussing the latest in horror goodness, including the remake of the 1985 classic The Color Purple. So come on in to DeadPit.com and support gay marriage, damn it.
Okay. So I hope y'all enjoyed those promos. I know that I enjoyed listening to them.
Yeah, that was a really good impersonation of both of us there by Donnie Miller.
Yeah, he even, like, I just thought he was like my next door neighbor or something. He had the accent down pretty good. So, the tarot card stuff, we're going to continue to give those away, but we're not going to make it as difficult as, I don't know if it was difficult or what, but two more packs of tarot cards we're giving away. The question is, which horror star does not have a tarot card available to buy on tarotcards.com?
Is it Debbie Rashawn? Is it
Linnea Quigley?
Or is it Tom Atkins?
So the first one to get that correct wins two packs of tarot cards, which also has randomly inserted autographs in the packs and all that.
Seriously, if you don't get that right, you're a fucking idiot.
Yeah. So, we will be back with the DVD reviews, and we're going to have another trivia question for you guys to win the Zenon Pictures DVDs. So, we'll be back after this quick break here on Dead Pit.
Dead Pit.
Alan Danziger. I play Jerry in the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and you're listening to DeadPit.com.
Summer has come and passed. The innocent can never last.
What began as a vacation ended as a nightmare.
Can I come, please?
Sue me!
The story of an American family who lost everything except the will to survive. The hills have eyes.
Back here on Dead Pit Radio. And now we're going to do a little trivia question for the Zenon Pictures release films that we've got. And are we sending two films this time?
Yeah.
Because if we
just
do that,
two films, we're going to send Reality Kills and Headhunter.
Which Headhunter I don't believe has been released yet.
Yeah, Headhunter comes out next month. Yeah. The question is, which hip-hop superstar is in Reality Kills?
Is it A, Jay-Z?
B, Snoop Dogg?
Or C, Sticky Fingers?
So, first one to get that correct will win two more DVDs from Zenon Pictures here on DeadPit.com.
And you can email the answers to DeadPit@DeadPit.com.
That's right, folks. So be sure to check out every DVD that Zenon Pictures offers on their website. And, you know, if you happen to win the DVDs, please email them and thank them, and maybe we'll offer some more in the future. Who knows? Because I love doing these little contests so other fans can get in on the horror goodness that is Zenon Pictures.
There's a lot of people, I think we talked about this before, they just got the Snoop Dogg's Hood of Horror.
Hood of Horror.
Horror DVD picked up, yeah. Not so, Hood of Horrors, that would be a great film too. But,
yeah. Yeah. Well, Let's get right to the DVD reviews, though. We got a great abundance of these this week.
We've got so many DVD reviews, y'all just shit your panties.
Yep. First one I want to talk about is After Sundown.
Mm-hmm. Which, and I have to say this before we even get into the review of this movie, the copy of this movie that I got for review was an original edit that had not been sent to the producers, apparently, for, you know,
whatever reason.
Yeah, editing or whatever. So we don't know if this will be the exact same movie that will be released, but it will be close anyway, I'm sure.
Yeah. From Michael W. Brown of Brown Cow Productions.
Yeah.
We have this little ditty of a movie.
Okay, so what we have here is basically, it's like a bunch of different genres in one movie. It's kind of like a Western mixed with a vampire film mixed with a zombie film.
Mm-hmm.
And in the beginning of it, we go back to the 1800s, and there's a woman that's getting ready to have a baby who has actually been infected and turned into a vampire. And now her father wants to kill her and the baby. But as he's getting ready to do this, a head vampire who's able to raise the dead, you know, through some kind of telepathy or something, comes into town. He carries a six-shooter, too, for some reason. I don't know why he doesn't just kill him like a vampire. But
yeah, he's like a zombie vampire Clint Eastwood.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you flash forward to modern day, and they actually find the body with the stake still in the chest of the woman and the baby. And, of course, some jackass who's never seen a horror film in their life removes the stake.
Yeah.
Which we all know, if you remove the stake from a vampire, what happens?
It reanimates.
That's right. So, and then the rest of the film is just, you know, your basic vampires and zombies coming back to life.
Yeah, there's not really a plot to it that much. It's a little bit of a clusterfuck, but I halfway enjoyed it. I mean, I thought the zombie vampire, like, cowboy guy was a really cool character. You know, I could see that working in a slasher movie or something.
Yeah. It had a good premise. The whole idea of the Western meets zombies and stuff.
I don't think they really knew how to execute it correctly, though.
I don't think they had a real good idea of what they wanted to do. And there's not, another thing that hurts this film is there's not a lot of gore in it. And the special effects, even the makeup effects, the prosthetics are kind of bad. You can see
you
where
can
the...
definitely see the seam in it, you know, where they had it. And towards the end, too, they also had a really horrible CG effects added, which I'm going to tell you independent people again, stay away from CG in independents especially. You can't do it right for a low budget.
That's true. Yeah, you really have to have, like, Peter Jackson money to make CG look worth the piss.
And even sometimes that looks really bad, you know, like in King Kong. So,
but in closing, though, what'd you say? I'd say rent it.
Yeah, I would slightly recommend it. Probably not to buy it. See it on TV, or you want to rent it or something.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure Lionsgate is actually releasing this film too.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, maybe they can edit it together and fix it a little bit. You know.
Yeah, like I say, you know, this is just an original edit that we got to screen. So
yeah, so you can check that out at browncowproductions.com.
Moving on, we have our next review from Anchor Bay Entertainment, and it comes to us with Lance Henriksen, who's starring in a shitload of horror movies these days. Brian Wimmer and Sean Young, who I haven't seen anything since, probably Ace Ventura.
Yeah.
But and it was directed by a guy by the name of Don Michael Paul. This is called The Garden.
That's right. And this is, you know, a small horror element, more fantasy-based, especially towards the end.
Yeah.
You've got this, about 12-year-old, 13-year-old little boy that is mentally disturbed.
Yeah, he has a propensity to have night terrors, I think.
Yeah, and he cuts himself and stuff like that. As his father's taking him from a mental asylum to live with his mom or something like that, they have a crash, and it seems like, I thought it would go back to this story where they crashed and his father looked dead, but it never did. Like, I thought, you know, maybe because he was having night visions, and I thought that this was a part of a vision. Anyway, though, Lance Hendrickson saves him and takes him back to his ranch, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And they live with him for a while, which was bizarre because they didn't know him before.
Yeah, well, I think wasn't his father a carpenter or something like that, and he gave him work around the house, and they couldn't get back until they fixed the car or something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, and then you start to find out little things about Lance Hendrickson's character, and then there's another character that's a teacher.
Right.
And there's a character Sean Young. There's a character played by Claudia Christian, who was in The Hidden. I don't know. She was the only woman that got taken over by the parasite thing in The Hidden.
Yep.
But and towards the end of the film, it kind of starts to make sense. And I have to say that the plot has its problems, to say the least.
It definitely drags. The movie drags in certain spots.
Lance Hendrickson is just a really great actor to be able to play.
He did an awesome job in this movie, and he's probably one of the only reasons the movie halfway worked.
Yeah. And it does only really work for him because the kid in this movie, and I can't think of his name, Adam Taylor Gordon.
Yeah, it's probably his first movie, too.
He's a really bad actor, though. Yeah. I mean, really bad.
Well, in general, kids are pretty bad. That's why if there are actually decent kid actors, they're overused a lot.
Yes, they should just CG Dakota Fanning's head on that kid.
Yeah.
But there's
a reason it's called The Garden.
And
we don't really want to give it away. That would give way too much of it away. Let's just say that Lance Hendrickson's pretty much the devil.
Yeah, and that should pretty much give it away. But
Lance Hendrickson always plays a bad guy anyway. So you know that going in, that there's something evil about him.
I actually didn't think. Here's what I thought. Like, I was watching the movie and I was thinking to myself, I think somewhere towards the end of the movie, if they're really going to do it, Lance Hendrickson will turn out to be the good guy. And then one of these other people, like Sean Young's character, would turn out to be something evil. Of course, they never did that, thinking, you know.
Yeah, if they spend the cash on Lance, then they have to get their money's worth of him being a bad guy.
Well, they definitely got their money worth, I'll say that. This is another one I would rent, too. I don't think I would buy this one.
No. It gets, on the internet, it's been getting shit on pretty regularly in reviews.
Yeah.
I don't think it really deserves that, although it really isn't that great either. But, I don't know. I mean, the first 30 minutes of it led me to believe that it was going to be great. Last 10 minutes of it, pure shit.
That's probably pretty accurate. But the DVD is widescreen, of course, has audio commentary with the director, has a behind-the-scenes featurette, and theatrical trailer and all the stuff that Anchor Bay usually puts on there. And, of course, you can go to anchorbayentertainment.com to check it out.
Definitely better than another movie I don't think we talked about on the show, but it's another one of the Anchor Bay newer releases, Malevolence. It's definitely a lot better than that.
Yeah, it is 10 times better than that movie. That's one of the worst new horror films I've seen.
Here's one from somebody we're going to have on the show next week, Amy Lynn Best.
Uh-huh. She'll be our featured guest.
The Spicy Sisters Slumber Party. Now, this is a documentary film, and I thought it was a really great idea for a documentary film. You have basically roundtable discussions with Scream Queens, as they're all in pajamas and
it's
laying.
Like a round bed discussion because they're in like a huge bed and a hotel room.
Yeah.
But you've got a really good idea here, which is, you know, documentaries, horror documentaries right now are extremely popular. You've got at least five or six I can think of getting ready to come out, you know, with Rise and Fall.
We'll be talking about another one on here, too.
Yeah. But there's 80s horror and the rise and fall of horror and the rise and fall of slashers and just tons of stuff like that. But this one is just independent scream queens. You got Robin Griggs, Lilla Stabbs, Riley Morgan,
J.C. Lanier.
Yeah, J.C. Lanier. And there's Amy Lynn Best is in there too.
Linnea Quigley.
They actually get around to Debbie Rochon and Linnea Quigley
in different separate segments.
But, the whole idea is just to go around and talk about the state of women in horror films today, especially independent horror films.
And a lot of their experiences, too.
Yeah, and, you know, when you get around to talking to people like Linnea Quigley, you do kind of wonder what it was like back in the 80s and even in the 70s to some extent to come up like and be a scream queen. And today, because she's got tons of films.
The only gripe that I had was, because that was a segment I was most looking forward to, And she seemed to really not talk too much during that segment, and it was short.
Wasn't there something where the police came in, they thought they were making a porno or something?
Yeah, they started comparing how they would do nude scenes, and they'd be considered porn stars on the internet because, you know, I don't know if any of y'all ever tried this, but I've done it before. Like, you know, if you type in, just say, Debbie Rashawn's name in Yahoo and you don't have the adult
block thing
checked, yeah, it'll bring up a ton of porno pictures, basically. I think that's what they were talking about, and then the police were called, and they got kicked out of the pool area.
Because they thought they were getting ready to make a lesbian porno of it. But, yeah, it's got some good segments, some good discussion about, you know, independent horror films in general and, you know, how these women feel about their place in it. I actually probably enjoyed just the regular roundtable thing more than I did the stuff with Debbie Rashawn and Linnea Quigley, actually.
Because I know Linnea really didn't she was completely left out of Something to Scream About, I believe. She wasn't involved in that.
Yeah.
And to me, she is the Scream Queen.
But the thing about this is, though, they could put together anybody that had to do with horror, and I'd watch it and like it.
I enjoyed it. And I believe this is available at happycloudpictures.net now. You can check that out there.
I'm sure you could buy it off any of those sites, Amy Lynn Best.
I love stuff like this. I love any horror documentary, and this is no exception, folks.
Can't go wrong with that. And up next is a film that I'd heard about for probably at least a year.
Mm-hmm.
I've been hearing about it. And a lot of people gave it some really good reviews, and it's called Andre the Butcher. And it's supposed to star Ron Jeremy.
I can't wait to talk about this.
It's directed by a guy by the name of, I think this is Philippe Cruz, for a company called Think Film. Okay. Let me say about this movie.
Well, the best thing I can say about it, if you look at the cover, the movie is the exact opposite of what you would think it would be by looking at the cover.
Yeah, you know how the tagline for Pieces is, it's exactly what you think?
Yeah.
Well, the tagline for this movie should be, it's not anything what you fucking think.
Because, all right, if you look at the cover, you have somebody that vaguely looks like Ron Jeremy in, like, a doctor's outfit or something. And he doesn't wear that outfit throughout the whole movie.
No, he wears a welder's mask, from what I can recall.
Yeah, and that usually, when he has the welder's mask on, that's not Ron Jeremy.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say Ron Jeremy might have had 2 days worth of shooting in the movie.
So let's just give a brief.
Not like he's a big draw or anything. But
if you're going to base a movie completely around one guy, and the name of the movie is his character's name, you should at least have the guy in the damn movie.
Yeah.
But a group of cheerleaders, including one male cheerleader, is going to like the intercollegiate cheerleading championships or something like that.
Yeah, for community colleges.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter. Anyway, their car breaks down on the side of the road, and it just so happens that a local legend is Andre the Butcher. It's this guy that, you know, is supposed to be living in this house, and who you eventually come to find out is kind of like, what is he, like the devil supposed to be? He shows people their sins and...
I don't know exactly what he is. I think he's like a ghost, but he doesn't look like a ghost.
Yeah, one time, I know there was a flashback, because one time he went to church and he had a family and all this stuff, and then they died in a car accident,
and
he came back to life. He's some kind of demon or something.
Anyway, started killing people and grinding them up.
And he shows everybody their sins and all this crap, but... It's basically like
actually, he only showed one person their sins.
Yeah, there's like a thousand.
They just assumed that, you know, he showed everybody his sins. The movie is a clusterfuck. That's the best way to describe it. You've got way too many characters in the movie. At first, you just start out with the cheerleaders.
Yeah.
Then it just seems to go to these black DEA officers or something. Then you go to...
Really fucking bad actors in this movie.
A couple of prisoners... that escape.
The DEA woman you mentioned, that's got to be one of the worst actresses I've seen in a long time in any kind of horror film. But yeah, you're right. It's some really bad acting. And for a movie that's called Andre the Butcher, there's not much gore in this movie at all.
No. And there's a lot of like comedic elements. Supposed to be comedic.
Yeah.
Like there's this one guy that you see his guts hanging out and stuff. And it keeps coming back to him. Kill me. You know, it stopped being funny after the second time.
It wasn't even really funny to begin with. But Yeah, I wouldn't recommend this film at all.
I wouldn't either.
So, it was all hype. I think that the hype for this film, around at least the internet.
Yeah, this is another one I believe that, for some reason, gets fairly good ratings on the internet.
You know,
which is another reason why we don't really listen to anybody. We watch these movies and give you our honest opinion. And, you know, there's nothing really redeeming about it. Something that's, else that's funny about it is Ron Jeremy isn't even hardly in the movie. You can definitely tell when they cut to just a guy that's probably two times smaller than him playing his double.
Mm-hmm.
Where they just put the welder's mask on is
there's almost everything in this movie doesn't work.
It comes off as extremely generic.
I think that's the best thing we can say about it. Just doesn't work.
Yeah.
So what do we got next?
We have a movie from Martin Garrido Barone, and this is H6
Diary of a Serial Killer.
That's right.
Okay. People out there that are fans of movies where you just have like a central character like Henry and Henry and Portrait of the Serial Killer, or you know, just you have one main character like American Psycho,
yeah,
who goes around and it's just basically scenes from his life and how he lures women into being tortured and eventually killed,
mm-hmm,
then you would really like this movie.
I think it's described as the Spanish Hostel. To me, if Hostel was more like this movie, I would probably liked it.
Here's the thing about this movie that I would say would be my biggest endorsement of it. It doesn't have a lot of gore in it at all, really.
Yeah.
But what is left unseen, and because of the actresses mostly in the film, it really works because yeah, you can imagine how horrifying it is. And you know,
what I think is cool, too, is they really didn't do it in Hostel, is they give you a backstory on who the killer is, pretty much. Like, well, not really a backstory, but he's the star. You basically see what he does, where I think his aunt or somebody dies and leaves him this apartment building or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, it's definitely character-driven.
Yeah, and you see him from that moment when he gets the building to he decides to make a diary when he starts killing these prostitutes. And he basically designs this room, covers it in plastic, the entire room.
Puts a big-ass table in it with, like,
handcuffs and stuff.
Yeah, and foot, leg cuffs and stuff like that.
And, you know, decides to tie these prostitutes up and say he's a sadist and he just wants to do these little sexual deviant things.
It's all about him and his ability to trick women into these situations.
And once the woman is handcuffed, he leaves her there for a couple of days and starts fucking her at first. Then she begs for something to drink. He just throws piss on her face. And I enjoyed that. It gives you a lot more information on the exact opposite of a Hostel. Sort of. Like, you don't really know or care about the guy that was the killer in Hostel. Whereas this guy makes it seem more real.
Well, there was like several killers in Hostel, really. I mean, it wasn't.
Well, the main guy, though, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and
they made.
Even this movie has like the actors and the lead actor and the actresses in the movie are a lot better than anything Hostel ever talked about. I don't want to even compare this movie to Hostel because that'd be an insult.
But after he tortures the women for days and fucks them, too, he just cuts them up into many, many pieces and makes steak out of
them. He makes a whole like freezer full of stuff for him. I think he's got a wife in it, like a common law wife or something. Yeah. But yeah, the best thing I can say for it is great acting. It doesn't have a lot of gore, but you don't really need it because he leaves a lot to the imagination. And a director that actually knows how to build a little bit of suspense and a character.
Yeah, actually, and it's got a pretty cool ending too.
Yeah,
if you stick around, it's not what you expect. But.
So yeah, I would recommend this.
Yeah, and our good friends at Tartan USA.com has this, so check it out. I don't know if it's out yet, but.
And I think this is the last thing that we've got for review.
Well,
and probably one of the greatest things I've had the pleasure to see in a long time.
Yeah, especially for review. Think about it. I mean, it's probably one of the coolest things we've ever gotten to review yet.
This is called Halloween 25 Years of Terror,
which is the Holy Grail for Halloween fans.
It really is, though. I mean, I always considered myself more of like a Romero fan, and then Carpenter would come next probably. But when you watch this documentary, you can't help but just get sucked into like all the Halloween movies.
And we're not just talking about the documentary itself. We're talking about the extras. They're just sort of addicting.
There is a, okay. So the thing about this film is the actual film is a documentary narrated by PJ Souls that chronicles like all of the Halloween films. Yep. And like their impact, and it has people from each film to talk about, you know, their roles and just different things like that. But that's not the main draw of the film, even though that documentary is great in and of itself. Yep. But the main draw is there's two discs in this, and the first disc has tons of extras on it, and the second disc is just special features.
Filled with extras.
And it's all based around a convention that was done in 2003, which was called Haddonfield, Return to Haddonfield.
Yeah.
And it was a fan-based convention. Fans actually put this together and got most of the people back from all of these different Halloween films to do like a kind of Q&A with fans and with a moderator.
Yeah, and they've got those panels on there for like Halloween 1, 2, 6. They got like a Michael Myers panel.
You got a panel with all the Michael Myers on it. You got a panel, an Ellie Cornell panel, which is just her talking about 4 and 5.
Yeah.
You've also got, in the actual documentary itself, it talks a lot about with Danielle Harris and Sasha Jensen, although they're not on the special features, which was odd.
I don't know if they could fit all that stuff, but.
And you've got extended interviews with people from the cast of Halloween 2 and Halloween 3, and I know Tom
Atkins. All this stuff is, what, at least 10, 15 minutes each?
It's
like over 4 hours of extras.
The panel discussions are each at least 30 minutes. So you're talking about, like, hours upon hours. And there's stuff in here like how they got the name from Michael Myers and, you know, where the mask came from, how they designed the mask, and just and behind-the-scenes stories from each film that are really great.
One thing I was thinking about today about the movie is it was almost like if they it's like a movie version of if they did like a Halloween book on the whole series, you know, like they did the Crystal Lake Memories.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly like that. Like, say, for instance, if they made a Crystal Lake Memories DVD and interviewed all those people. That's what this is.
Now, I've seen, and I have to say, I've seen documentaries like we saw Texas Chainsaw Massacre one. I know I bought that, Shocking Truth. And we've seen Romero, you know, Document of the Dead. But for my money, this has got to be the best one
I've ever seen. I'm sure a lot more will come out after this because, you know, this will probably be Anchor Bay's biggest DVD of the year. I'll put my money on it right now because, you know, they're. Think about it. The fans of Halloween made the convention, you know.
Yeah.
There's so many fans involved that they funded the freaking convention on their own. So that alone will make it probably the biggest DVD of the year. And another funny thing about the actual documentary, I don't know if you all know that the Heather Bowen, I believe is her name, that won the
walk-on part
for Halloween 9. You get to see her tits in this.
Yeah, that's always a draw.
I love that. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't expecting that at all. I was like, holy shit.
But there's really not enough good things I can say about this. I mean, it's everything that I thought it was going to be and like 2 more hours of shit.
And there's actually a written review on the message board of this, and it'll have a direct link to where you can buy it for around $12.
Yeah, I
can't. And this is totally worth that. I mean, you know.
But when I was watching that, I found myself thinking, I found myself actually like starting to wonder if I really liked Friday 13th as much as I thought I did. Because that's how much that the documentary actually makes you think about Halloween films.
Yeah.
It makes you almost forget every other slasher film you've ever seen.
Well, Halloween started. I mean, it started the big craze in the mid to late 80s or early to mid 80s.
Yeah, but all I'm saying is that it's really involved and it's fan-based. And there's a lot of stuff in there that you won't ever see in other documentaries, like fans that jump up and get, like, want hugs from people in the cast.
Yeah.
And fans that ask some of the questions, like if you're really nervous and you sit at home on, like, type on a message board.
Yeah.
You know, they ask questions like that. Like, just the stupidest shit you
another,
can think of.
Another cool feature on the DVD, too, and I know we're talking about this long, but I really like the Horror's Hallowed Grounds show that they had. It's actually a show that the Horror Channel produced, I believe. And they actually go to all of the on-location spots. I believe it was in Pasadena, California, where they filmed Halloween, and show you what they look like now. Like, you can see the actual the Strode house and the school where they, you know, where Michael stalks Tommy Doyle. Just all kinds of spots like that. And PJ Souls is actually hosting that with the main host.
Sean Clark, I think was his name. Yeah. But anyway, yeah. There's so much crap on this, like, as far as extras and features.
And besides, hey, if the features don't grab you, the goddamn case will. Like, it's probably one of the best artwork on a case that I've seen. If you aren't even a horror fan, you're probably like, oh, God, that looks freaking cool. So, Anchor Bay did another freaking kick-ass job with this set. And buy it.
Yeah, don't wait around for it. Just buy it right now. You're really never going to find anything that tops this, I don't think, in the ways of Halloween documentaries.
No, this is the Halloween set to get, and, you know, I was just happy as hell to watch it finally, and I'm sure we'll watch it many, many times over the next few years.
So you pick this up, do what
we
say.
Halloween 25 Years of Terror from Anchor Bay. Go to anchorbayentertainment.com, go to Amazon,
go anywhere.
Wherever, buy it.
You'll probably find it. But yeah, if you don't have this, you're retarded. So,
that's it. That's the show. Next week's show, we have Amy Lynn Best, who gave us a wonderful interview this week.
She was nice enough to sit down and talk to us, and she got some truly interesting things about, you know, all of her horror films that she's been a part of.
And also, we can mention some stuff that's out there on the website. I know we have a new interview with Barbie Wilde, who was another Cenobite in Hellraiser 2.
Mm-hmm. That goes along with the Simon Bamford interview that I've got up, and he was one of the original Cenobites in Hellraiser.
So we got that, and we got actual, like, if you go on our reviews, you can help support DeadPit.com by, you know, buying a movie that you like that we reviewed. We've got the links up there. All that financial goodness.
Yeah.
So, I guess we'll be back next week on DeadPit.com. We're not doing nothing else, you know.
We live in Kentucky, so we'll be around. I mean,
all we can do is either plunge toilets or mine coal or whatever. So we'll see you here next week on DeadPit.com.